to be back at SBL and AAR annual meetings in person. We haven't done this lunch since 2019, so we're excited to be here. I'm Irina Fascianis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach at CFR. So thank you for being with us. This luncheon is hosted by CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy Program, which serves as a resource for faith leaders and policymakers and offers a forum for congressional leaders, seminary heads, scholars of religion, and representatives of faith-based organizations to discuss global issues in an interfaith environment. If you're not already a participant in our activities, we hope you will join us. Our programming includes two webinar series, a religion and foreign policy series, and a social justice series, roundtables, tailored briefings by subject experts, and a monthly bulletin. After the conference, we will send you an invitation to our next webinar, so look out for that. It will be on religious freedom and U.S. national security. And in the meantime, if you haven't already, please visit us at our booth. The booth number is 127. So I'm delighted to introduce our moderator, who will facilitate today's discussion, Jennifer Butler, founder and residence of Faith in Public Life. We have extensive bios in the programs at your seats, so you can look more there. But I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer to introduce our panelists. Jennifer, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Welcome, everyone. And a big thank you to Carnegie Council for Foreign Affairs for pulling together such cutting-edge topics, such important discussions. I know we all benefit from these on a regular basis. And this topic could not be more pressing today if we're going with the AAR theme of catastrophes, looking at the state of democracy and human rights around the world. We're facing a downright recession in human rights globally. And in democracy, which safeguards many of those rights, over a quarter of the world's population now lives in a backsliding democracy. Countries such as Brazil, now the United States, by some measures, figures into that backsliding category, Hungary, Poland, Slovenia. And then together with those living in non-democratic regimes, they make up more than two-thirds of the world population. So two-thirds of the world population are living either in what is categorized as a backsliding democracy, hence where human rights are under threat, or in a non-democracy regime. And religion, of course, is playing a complex role in that as part of civil society, both in terms of fostering or weakening human rights. And it plays an even more complicated role when it becomes a political ideology, as we see in the rise of religious nationalisms around the world, but also when religion is exploited as a tool of Western hegemony as well. And so there's a lot of complicated dynamics that these two scholars are going to be incredible at helping us to unpack. So we are very lucky to have them. And with that, I would like to introduce these astonishing professors here. Shadi Mukhtari is an assistant professor at the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C. Her teaching and research focus on the politics of human rights is on the politics of human rights, the dynamics of political change in the Middle East, and on political Islam. And she is the author of After Abu Ghraib, Exploring Human Rights in America and in the Middle East, which was Cambridge University Press. And that book was the co-winner of the 2010 American Political Science Association Human Rights Section Best Book Award. From 2003 to 2013, she served as editor-in-chief of the Muslim World and Journal of Human Rights. And her current research develops a typology of Middle Eastern experiences of the international human rights framework and is entitled Experiencing Human Rights as Mockery of Morality, Manifesting Morality, and Moral Maze, the Resonance of Human Rights Rhetorical Promise and the Unpersuasiveness of Its Practice to Middle Eastern Populations. That is a mouthful, but a critical, critical theme for today, and one we will be discussing in depth. Dr. Ebenezer Obadari is the Douglas Dillon Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Before joining CFR, he was professor of sociology at the University of Kansas. He was a political reporter for the News and Tempo magazines from 1993 to 95, and he is the author of numerous books. Dr. Obadari's most recent book just came out this year from University of Notre Dame Press, and it's entitled Pastoral Power, Clerical State, Pentecostalism, Gender, and Sexuality in Nigeria. He is the editor of the Journal of Modern African Studies and a contributing editor to Current History. He was the Ralph Derendorf Scholar and Ford Foundation International Scholar at the London School of Economics. And these two have so many accomplishments, I will not read them all off, but they are in your bio. So our first question today to open up this conversation is going to be, and I think I'll start with you, Dr. Obadari, because you're looking straight at me, and we've been bantering beforehand.
I shouldn't have done that.
Never make eye contact, right? Then you end up going first. I wanted to start off with both of you just asking, what is the current state of human rights in the area that your expertise is in? And then we're going to delve deeper into some very complicated questions. What is the state of human rights, and what role are religious organizations playing in this struggle? Yeah. And what are the tensions between religion and human rights broadly?
Yeah, thank you for that. Good to see, good to be here. Thank you for attending this panel. So my work is on Africa, so I'm going to speak generally about human rights struggle in Africa. I think the first point to sort of get out is that you can't understand human rights struggle in Africa unless you put it within the broader context of the struggle for the inauguration of liberal democratic norms across the continent. So for the last 3 to 4 decades, many of African countries have been involved first in the struggle to remove the military from power in different countries, and then consequent upon that, in the struggle to institute democratic norms in the country, in the continent. So the language of human rights itself has to be inserted within that broader struggle to remove the military from power, first and foremost, but also to have liberal democratic norms be the modus operandi, in different African countries. And you could say that to a large extent, considerable, progress has been made, in different parts of the continent. Even though, if you've been reading the news over the last 5 to 6 months, you also see that there's cause for, for disenchantment because of the spate of coups d'etat that we've had, especially in some West African countries. Guinea, Mali, Chad, Burkina Faso, comes to mind. So some of that points to the fact that some of the good things that we've experienced with respect to the consolidation of human rights and democratic norms, you start seeing a reversal of some of those norms, especially with those military coups. And to sort of give a sense of the condition in the continent right now, from a high of about 25, 30 in the mid 1990s, consequent upon the fourth wave of democratization on the continent, Freedom House now says that only 11 African countries can broadly be categorized as free. And Freedom House, I don't know if you know about their index, they use, free and fair elections, freedom of the press, property rights, different things like that as barometer to measure the progress of different countries, on the road to democracy. The other part of your question is the role that religious agents have played in this struggle. And I think it's an extremely complex subject, but you could sort of divide that, into two. One is the way in which different religious, organizations and religious institutions basically turned the mosque or the pulpit, as the case may be, into religious platforms. Right. So religious agents, pastors, imams, became, especially when the continent was under the cosh of the military, they turned those platforms into political platforms. So religious agents or religious organizations of various sorts were part of the campaign to inaugurate human rights and liberal democratic norms on the continent. But the much more important contribution that I think religious agents and religious institutions, performed was in the very philosophizing of the struggle itself. The way in which the struggle to institute human rights was turned into a demon versus saint kind of thing, where the military was the demon and all the other forces within civil society ranged against them became the saints. So that philosophy was actually much more important than the actual work that some of them did, you know, on the pulpit or, you know, inside the mosque. And I think, you know, to close on maybe a more skeptical note, it's also to point out that even though religious agents and religious institutions have been so central to the work of, you know, inaugurating liberal democratic norms and human rights on the continent, that some of the more recent tensions over sexual and reproductive rights sort of call us back to the fact that while we ought to celebrate, you know, the involvement of religious agents and actors in politics, oftentimes, you know, when you now see some of the other things happening, you know, especially over the last 5 to 10 years with respect to LGBT rights, sexual rights, you know, pregnancy, you know, echoes of Roe v. Wade, you know, on the continent, you sort of see a different kind of, maybe much more conservative role for religious agents. So I'm going to stop there.
Yeah, thank you for that complex picture. Dr. Mokhtari, what would you say?
Yeah, so if we were to think of the big picture of human rights in the Middle East and in North Africa, it is at once you know, very dire and promising as well, with caveats, of course. So on the side of, you know, very dire conditions, you know, repression essentially reigns in most parts of the region. You have, you know, if we were to think of human rights in civil and political terms alone, and of course, there are social and economic rights, there's the right to an environment, all of these are also very much compromised right now. But just on the repression level, they're widespread repression, right? A lot of authoritarian regimes who rule through repression. The very promising 2011 Arab Spring, you know, many of those movements have kind of taken a very dark turn. Three civil wars, tremendous human toll, you know, in Syria and Yemen, and Libya as well, and then the second wave of protests, which took place, you know, around 2019 in Algeria, Sudan, Lebanon, and Iraq, which didn't get much coverage, unfortunately, in the West. But those are kind of in this very stalemate, you know, state where we don't know where they're headed. But the other side of it, what is really promising in my view, is that, you know, there is broad segments of these societies, and of course there's diversity in the region, and then I really can't speak of the Gulf region much, because it's not my area of expertise, but in many of these other contexts, what the norms of the Human Rights Project and democratic liberal norms have broadly been embraced and overlap considerably with both the grievances and the aspirations of large segments of the population, and in particular, you know, the younger generation, who seems to be really driving the various protest movements. They are up against a lot of structural barriers, and also kind of 21st century divide and rule devices and through the means of social media, which has been a very effective means for authoritarian regimes in the region to divide and rule in a sense, or divide and conquer and rule. So in any case, there's a lot I can say about these protest movements and kind of the underlying promise, and I would say new generation of human rights activism. But I think I'll dig deeper with some of the other questions, so okay. I'll leave it there.
Good, yeah, you piqued my interest there. Maybe we could stay with you for a minute, just to continue in that vein. The Middle East has been thought to be a place where there is cultural and religious resistance to human rights, but your research has really challenged that. So can you help us understand?
So what I would say is that I've been visiting different countries in the region for over 20 years, and inevitably I'd be in a taxi somewhere or in a situation where someone we strike a conversation. They ask me what I am there for, and I say, my research relates to human rights. And as soon as I use, it's usually not a expression that's used internally, I had noticed, but when I bring it up, almost kind of on key, the response would be, what human rights? Human rights don't exist. And so over the years, I have come to the conclusion that while there may be these kind of religiously rooted, culturally rooted, social norm rooted rejections of specific human rights norms, it's not really the content, by and large. I mean, the bigger picture is that, by and large, people do not object to the core emancipatory promise of the Human Rights Project. What it is that really makes them keep a distance from it is that, the practice as they see it around them is so widely corrupted. And that's what I mean by experiencing human rights as a mockery of morality. So you can look at, the way Western governments, right, and particularly the United States, have deployed human rights in conjunction with a host of very problematic, geopolitical policies and essentially their hegemony in the region. And that what human rights, there are no human rights retort, I heard the most right after 9/11, right, and after Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and all of this came out. So there is this depoliticization of the human rights conditions in the region that the West contributes to. I mean, in addition to kind of the commissions that take place after 9/11, there's a host of other ways that human rights discourse becomes a discourse that's widely corrupted mm-hmm. in the region. The focus on just women's rights as if, attributing all the human rights ills of the region simply to backwards culture and religious practices, right, is a way to depoliticize. So in any case, I mean, I could go on about this quite a bit, but this is what I think, often kept people wanted to keep a distance from that discourse. Now, what I then go on to discuss is how that shifts in a lot of places after 2011, and it's, that unpersuasiveness of human rights, the un is in parentheses, because it can be persuasive if it's practiced in a way that's considered, not disingenuous, right, which is the way that it's widely been experienced, not only because of, the Western role and kind of the hollowness of Western rhetoric on human rights, but also the way their own authoritarian regimes are able to game the system because of the way there's an NGO sector that, has conferences in five-star hotels and trainings, but in the end, nothing changes, right? And it seems like everyone's kind of, it's almost a farce. There's this discourse that promises so much and delivers so little to them. But that changes after, 2011, and I don't want to go on
That's
too long
Ghraib.
Here.
Yeah. After Abu Ghraib?
No. The uprisings in the Arab world, right? So then you have this new generation of human rights activists and social activists, social movement activists, who are deploying human rights very differently than it had primarily been deployed in the past. And it's about challenging the structures of power, economic and political, in a much more meaningful way than it had been in previous human rights discourses. Now, of course, then I talk about the moral maze, which is where, you have the polarization comes in, the disinformation, misinformation comes in, and then there's just endless contestation. The kind of moral clarity that you get at the inception of some of these protest movements gets more and more foggy. And if people are interested, I can, you know, elaborate on that. It's certainly something I'm worried about in terms of what's happening in Iran.
Why don't we move on to Africa for a bit, and then we'll come back to some of the nuance.
I just want to say one last sentence on the, because I didn't bring in the religion part in the initial answer. So I do think that political Islam is on its way out as an ideology, not religiosity within, you know, the different societies, and different societies are at different places, but I think that political Islam as a project, certainly in Iran, but also in a lot of Arab contexts, you know, was quite a force to reckon with around, you know, up until 2011, and then you had, I mean, I can get into the kind of the key points where there's a shift going on, but essentially at this point there are a lot of overall it's considered an experiment, an ideological experiment that's kind of run its course. I'll leave it there, and if we want to pick up on it.
And that's a big assertion and very exciting one. Yeah. So I'm sure we will have a time of Q&A, so prepare your questions now. Dr. Obadari, similarly, you've studied a very similar concept in African studies. The recent decolonial turn has targeted Western ideas and epistemologies, and as part of this movement, some scholars have even branded the idea of human rights as a Western construct. So what's your attitude toward this intellectual development, and do you see human rights as a Western construct?
I certainly do not. I think this is one of those moments when we have to be very careful. I think there's a tendency to conflate human rights with Western countries and the hypocrisy of Western countries. I could write 3 books on the hypocrisy of Western countries. I'm sure we all could. America has not always, the West in general has not always matched its rhetoric, you know, with its action. But that has nothing to do with human rights. Human rights, there are 2 components. I think we talk about rights, we forget about the first word, human. Human rights are universal. They transcend race, they transcend gender, they transcend sexuality, they transcend region. They are rights that pertain to you because you are human. Whatever corner of the world you live in, whatever historical oppression you've been exposed to, no matter how legitimate your grievances, that has nothing to do with the fact that human rights are human rights. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as African rights. There's no such thing as Arab rights. To the extent that those subcategories of rights exist, they exist under the broad rubric of human rights. It's the only thing that is left to the oppressed, you know, in different societies. So I was a journalist in Nigeria, you know, in the early 1990s. And when you live under military rule, you know, you appreciate what it means to be denied your human rights. So I think, the idea that human rights is a Western construct, I think it's absolutely ridiculous. But the other point is this: I think people also fixate on the genealogy of ideas, and then make inferences on the basis of those genealogies. So, if I say, "Oh, women have every right to be the equal of men," nobody in this room is going to ask me, where did that come from? Is that from Mongolia? No, it just seems intuitively right. I think the problem with decolonial scholarship, and you know, there is no time to sort of go into it in depth here. The problem is the failure to separate the genealogy of a concept, or even the hypocrisy of someone pushing a concept from the soundness of the concept or the principle itself. So when it comes to human rights, for me, the question is not whether the United States or the West has been hypocritical. The question is, and it's the same question I ask about every other principle, does it tend to human flourishing? Does it allow me to make a case for equality between men and women in an African context. It does. Human rights are not the property of any specific region or culture. Human is what you should focus on. To be human is to be universal.
Now you're preaching, I have to say.
I'm converted this place into a pulpit right now. So.
And I had to do like one of those kind of internal amens for a minute, because this concept of human flourishing or human dignity is one we've been using a lot at Faith and Public Life as we find human rights in America questioned, or in the United States, I should say, and even voting rights under question. And it leads me to this next question is, you two have already commented a bit on the connection between what's happening in the United States and the United States and its legacy and history and your respective regions. I wonder what impact the faltering of American democracy and human rights has, if any, on your regions, but also are there any other connections between the U.S. role in human rights in your regions that you wanted to illuminate for the participants here? Either one can go first.
I could build on what was just said. So you know, there's a very famous, I don't know, I'm sure you've seen Matua's savage victim savior metaphor of human rights. So it's, you know, an article from the early 2000s that really kind of illuminates the traditional, you know, what I've called the East-West geography of human rights, where, you know, there's this one-way traffic, right? Mm-hmm. And you have the savages in Matua's formulation are, you know, it's non-Western states, but really kind of underlying their savage culture. And then the victim is usually women and children in those non-Western contexts. And the savior is, you know, Western actors, states, NGOs, and in his formulation, you know, these principles, Western values. And it really does shed light on, I mean, it exists. This dynamic has been longstanding, and if you ever want to see an example of it, look at Barbara Bush's radio address right at, you know, when the U.S. is entering Afghanistan, and she talks about American troops saving Afghan women. I mean, it's the textbook example of Matua's savage victim savior. Now, what happens is that increasingly people are conscious of that saviorism kind of formulation of human rights. And so what we then get is a brand. So when you take that in conjunction with states like Iran's that and Syria and Russia that claim to be anti-imperialist in Venezuela, you know, where the state or the government is essentially saying, you know, we are, you know, against the West's imperialism. People who see savage victim savior then start focusing on Western hegemony in a way that then obscures, you know, the non-Western population's experiences of suffering vis-a-vis their own governments, right? So we're so fixated on Western imperialism, which exists and has been very problematic, that we then engage in a different kind of saviorism. What I'm trying to develop is a progressive form of saviorism where, and I'll wrap it up very quickly, the savage is you know, Western governments, and the savior is the population and the state, the victim is the population and the state, which are conflated. And the savior is kind of sometimes this anti-imperialist, leftist factions and their thought. And I think that is just as essentializing as the original form of savage victim savior. And it essentially obscures the lived experience of these populations, you know, who sometimes will say, as in Iran, yes, we understand what the U.S. has done to us and how the U.S. has been responsible to where we are today. But at the same time, our biggest battle right now is with our own regime. Mm-hmm. But that gets obscured. So
wow.
There's
part
a lot there. I said that in a...
Right?
I tried to make that as brief as I could, but there's a lot to say.
No,
here.
I'm feeling it every year. I'm feeling the complexity of it all. Dr. Obadar, you had a lot to say on this.
I find the travels of the United States instructive for a different set of reasons. I think it's actually something that maybe not to be applauded, but it's something that we should, that, so there are no perfectly democratic societies. There are democratizing societies. And different societies have made, you know, have achieved different levels of progress. I think there's no way of escaping the kind of travail that the United States, you know, is going through. If a multicultural country, you know, spread across, you know, such, you know, a wide geographic space, with people divided, you know, north and south, you know, east coast, west coast. If there's anything for me to take away, it is to tell people, you know, who look at the United States as a beacon of democracy and say, the United States remains a beacon of democracy. The fact that it's struggling does not make it less of a beacon. Mm. Look at what it's done right. Look at what it has done to get to where it is right now. Keep in mind that as you go along your own journey, maybe not the same thing, but variants of the same thing will happen to you. Why? Because democracy is work. If there's anything that we ought to blame the United States for, it is the hubris that gallivants and gambles and says, where is democracy, period, we've nailed it. I think the good thing about what has happened to us over the last 5-6 years is we are realizing that eternal, you know, like vigilance is the price of liberty. That even when you think you've done it all, because it's a democracy, there is always more work ahead. I'm taking that tack because I'm leery of, you know, either people, you know, on the extreme right or on the extreme left of the spectrum. On the extreme right, people would say, I told you democracy does not work. We prefer a theocracy. Yeah. And those on the extreme left who will say, I told you this thing doesn't work. We prefer some form of collectivization. Liberal democracy works. The United States is the perfect testimony to that. The fact that it is struggling is only a confirmation that it is not perfect. It does not mean that we should abandon democracy. If anything, the messiness itself is what recommends democracy.
Oh my gosh. That gives me great encouragement, actually. It reminds me of what John Lewis said right before he died about, you know, democracies don't just exist. You have to work for them. You have to struggle for them.
That's
essentially what they are. So thanks again for preaching. you're both preaching. But it's helpful because I think in these times we need some encouragement. And so as we look to close and kind of open things up to the audience, we've talked about the impact of the U.S. on your regions, but what are the implications of the struggles in your regions for the future of human rights? What lessons do you bring for the rest of the world, and what are the implications? And I know both of you want to comment on Iran too, and you might weave that into the context of that question and what's happening there.
I think I'm not even going to start on Iran. Very briefly, I would say that it is incredible to see women leading protests and men following their chants. And that says something. I mean, there's this really extraordinary shift in norms that's taking place, which does not mean patriarchy has been eradicated in Iran, as it has not been eradicated anywhere else. but there's something really, really very inspirational and you know, that speaks to the human quest for justice. that is very powerful coming out of Iran. Pay attention to that. There's also a lot of what I think is being talked about in kind of popular discourse in the U.S. as noise. So there's all sorts of, you know, there's a lot of contentiousness amongst diaspora groups and, you know, polarization and state-sponsored polarization and all sorts of actors in the region who would like to see Iran weakened but are not necessarily committed to meaningful political change. So there's, you know, it's going to be a very uphill battle, but I don't think the population is going to give up. And I don't think that's the case in Iran or a lot of the other places where we've seen protest movement, particularly the second wave. It's just covered up by the repression right now, but it will resurface when it can in other places. That's my own personal view. And I'll just say briefly about the contribution to human rights, just to connect it to what I said earlier, that human rights was a discourse that was dominated by, again, the kind of hollow, disingenuous, alienating politics and practice and discourses that encompass savage victim savior, in a sense. And, you know, it gave rise to a lot of cynicism. And I think the way that it's being practiced by protest movements in the Middle East breathes new life to the project, makes it something that's much more meaningful and kind of resonates with people beyond the region. And I must say that after 2011, we saw the rise of protest movements in a lot of places beyond the region. And these are protest movements that essentially have some element of rights demands and rights consciousness embedded in them. So, you know, for years, we've been seeing scholarship talking about the impending demise of the Human Rights Project. There's a book called The End of Human Rights, you know, and a lot of the problems with human rights, which, you know, I mean, some of them are very valid critiques. But I think, you know, the sense that human rights was out the door is it's not, right? And it's interesting to think of it in the sense that human rights was supposed to be something that saves the Middle East, according to the traditional kind of formulations. And it may just be that the Middle East and broader global South end up saving human rights. Nice. So that's just something to think about. It's
beautiful. Yes, Dr. Yeah. Obadar.
So quickly, Iran. I think a couple of things about Iran. One is to put it in the wider context of similar protests that have been going on in different parts of the world over the, you know, the last 5-7 years. The protests against the monarchy in Eswatini, in southern Africa, the anti-monarchy protests in Thailand, led by a human rights, you know, activist. I'm looking on some of the other, you know, protests, you know, going on out there now. But the Iranian struggle, you know, for women's liberation, for human rights, you know, has to be put in that context. To appreciate that context, please pay attention to the slogan: "Woman, life, freedom." I love all those three. There's nothing not to like in all three. What the women in Iran are saying is that they are tired of conservative, religious, persistent supervision of their lives. They want to have control over their bodies. You know where else they're saying that? In the United States, in the context of Roe v. Wade. So again, the universality of human rights. And part of what I think I find disappointing is that there hasn't been as much attention, you know, to, you know, the struggle in Iran, you know, and, you know, for all kinds of reasons, you know, I probably don't want to get into here. But if we say we care about human rights and gender equality, the struggle of the people, with the women of Iran, that's our struggle. That's absolutely our struggle. And it's one of those contexts in which the United States ought to play a leading role. I'm aware of white saviorism. The problem with white saviorism is that it reifies every attempt to intervene in the problem of another country. It's interpreted as white saviorism. No. If we believe in the universality of human rights, some forms of intervention are legitimate. There must actually be times when you back people up with muscle. I'm not saying we should back Iranian women up with muscle. I'm saying we should be as vocal and expressive enough in the United States to support what's going on, to give the women in Iran every bit of our support. And this takes me to the question about, maybe a couple of sentences about the United States itself. The most important thing, so in over the last 20, 25 years, the United States has given material and moral support to pro-democracy and human rights advocacy groups in Africa. We should continue to do so. But much more than the material support, what we ourselves represent is important. We cannot go abroad championing democracy if we can't have elections that are credible. We can't keep sending election monitors abroad to determine whether those elections are free and fair when our own elections are riddled with doubt, cynicism, and skepticism. The United States is the beacon of democracy in the world. It should not let the side down. Thank you.
Okay. Wow, lots to think about. And now it's your turn in the audience. So when you're ready, just raise your hand and we'll bring the mic over this way. We got a question here, one and one here on the edge. Okay. Then I saw you next and then here in front.
Thanks very much to the panel. I'm Kurt Richardson. I lead an academic philanthropy called Abraham's Bridge Institute for Abrahamic Relations. And we work to build capacity within universities and professional lives in the Middle East. So Lebanon, Iran, and Israel. They all have an obligation to each other if they only knew. One of the things I think that's extremely important about the work that is human rights, in many ways, if you can be in a partner attitude, if you do have access, then you are a shared co-laborer in the constant project that is democracy and human rights formulations. It's extremely important that a culture, a larger culture, multicultural, formulates their own document. So while things were downgrading so severely in Iran in the last decade, Rouhani fulfilled a promise of Khatami prior to Ahmadinejad that a formulation, an Iranian, authentically Iranian formulation would be produced. He gathered 180 Iranian scholars. It was not produced by the government. And there is now a statement in Farsi, Arabic, and English. The divisions between Shia and Sunni are more acute than they've ever been. All of the fault lines are along religion. And so although I'm a Protestant, I do commend most highly the work of Vatican II on dignitas humanae, on religious freedom of conscience. There is a special theological contribution born out of the religious wars of the 17th century that produced the basic theological foundations for liberty of conscience, that produces religious liberty, not merely toleration, that's majoritarian religious supervision of what is tolerable and what is intolerable, but rather on the basis of negative liberty, then an individual culture needs to appropriate an educational document, which is what the UN Statement of 48 really functioned as. But over the generations, it's produced the human rights courts in Canada. And the big question over and over is the separation of the religious court and the civil court. Mm-hmm. But until a culture has that acumen, they will not be able to educate their own people in human rights principles that have been contextualized, but in agreement with the universal humanity that you were describing. Thanks very much to this panel.
Thank you for that contribution. Let's also take a question over here so we can get a couple of things on the table for the panelists to respond to. And then we had a gentleman down front, and there's a woman way here in the back, so I can get each corner of the room at least. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for the panel. My name is Mia. I'm a professor at Georgia State. And I wanted to direct my question specifically to Dr. Obadare. So I do research on Boko Haram, and I work with Fatima Akilu in Abuja, and I work with Majid Peterks in Kaduna. And one of the things that has happened with the women who were freed, rescued from Sambisa, is that the military forces turned around and did to them what Boko Haram did to them. And so when we're talking about human rights, and we understand that it's usually clear who is the bad guys and who are the good guys, what do we do in a case like Nigeria when you have either the peacekeeping force, which isn't really keeping peace, or you have the soldiers in the military that are the ones also abusing human rights? And so this is why the women are running back to Sambisa, to their Boko husbands.
Thank you. But there is no problem there. You're describing a situation in which women are caught between male power on the point of view of Boko Haram and male power on the point of view of Nigerian soldiers. When it comes to the women, you're screwed. There's no conflict there. The way to get out of that, and I was going to ask the gentleman who spoke earlier about the document in Farsi, which connects to this. Did you read the document? What does it say about the rights of women? You can't say you want universal, right? And then not respect women. How are you going to do it? You want universal, right? As long as it suits men. The 100 people, it guarantees rights for women. The right for them to dress the way they like, to dispose, to own and dispose of property. Really? To marry whoever they want. Let's stop kidding around. Look, the argument for culture collapses once it, at a certain point, you cease to make progress with the argument for culture. Look, the argument for culture, you know how it affects me where I'm coming from? It basically says, I have a right to marry as many women as I like. I own them as property. The women have no right. I love that culture. Right? What about the women? Culture has to bow to the universal. It does not matter who is saying it. If a white person is saying it, the argument is still sound. The problem I think people face is because they say it's an American that is saying it, so the argument is flawed. Remove the person saying it. Go to space and say, I want men and women to be equal. It sounds right to me.
All right, we had a question, I promise, down here in the front, and then we're going to go to the back of the room here on the right. And then I'll watch for the other hands if we have time after that, trying to get everybody in.
Thank you. I am Rabbi Joe Charnas, and I have a question for Dr. Obadare. I appreciate your focus on the human dimension of human rights, because sadly, I think we often, all of us, focus on the rights part and forget that there's a human being that those rights are supposed to inspire and give dignity and meaning and hope to.
Yep.
I often speak of the humanity of rights. And my question for you is, when you spoke of human rights transcending race and culture and gender and society and religion, there's one area, unfortunately, that I don't think it transcends, and I wonder what is your at least attempted solution, or both of your solutions to this, because we're all in the same boat. Human rights, unfortunately, don't transcend politics. What do we do? I'm not looking for saviors, but I'm looking for some hope.
The key, the word is not transcend. The operative word is underpin. Right? If we're going to have a robust public sphere of deliberation, you know, a deliberative democracy, where I, a Muslim, am free to speak to the rabbi, where the rabbi is free to associate with one of the nuns. It has to be predicated on mutual respect. Where does that respect come from? It means I have to see you beyond your color. I have to see you beyond your gender, beyond your location, beyond your class. I see you as a human being. Is the most important attribute that we all bear. The human, that's where our dignity comes from. That's why certain things are forbidden. That's why we say you can't do that to a fellow human being. There's no problem here. Human rights is the very foundation of my own conception of politics.
Dr. Mukhtari, you want to tackle that one?
Well, let me actually go back to the Iran document that was mentioned. So I think part of the problem is the conflating of, you know, in well-intentioned kind of progressive attempts and you know, peace and conflict resolution type of attempts, the conflating of the state and the population, right? And states that claim to speak for, and this is kind of cultural relativism more broadly too, right? So I always tell my students, take cultural relativism claims seriously, but do not concede them on face value, because usually you have to ask, who is it that's making this claim? And you know, cultures are usually contested, religious interpretations are contested internally, they're dynamic. And so cultural relativism claims, a lot of them can be, you know, responded to by looking at who it is that's making the claim and what are their interests in that. So if you are at the helm of power, you know, and if you are a male, I mean, in the case of Iran, a male-dominated regime that constructs its ideology, you know, in opposition to the West by bringing in Islam, enlisting Islam, you know, that's not where the real work needs to be done in terms of bridging cultures and norms, I think. It has to really be done, you know, Khatami and Rouhani played an important role. In the end, their project failed. I mean, there's a lot to be said about them and kind of post-Islamists and the attempt to have Islamic reformist movements within the state in Iran. But in the end, the population was in a very different place, it seems like, normatively. There are religious segments of the society that need to engage in those, you know, have that kind of engagement in terms of, you know, human rights and where they feel that, you know, it does not coincide with their religious and cultural sense of morality. I mean, another debate we have in my human rights class is, you know, when is shaming effective and when do you need to have a engagement strategy and, you know, calling in versus calling out, when is each more appropriate and when is shaming going to backfire? And we talk about, you know, when people hold, I mean, FGM is a great example, people holding the belief that what they're doing is, you know, in line with their moral code, and you come in and you pass judgment on them and say you are being, you know, misogynist, you're a terrible, you know, that's where we should have engagement with people. But I would just caution against conflating and essentially doing what, you know, these states that claim to be anti-imperialist through their ideology want you to do, which is to conflate them and their agendas with that of, you know, their population. And in terms of sectarianism in the Middle East, a lot of that is fueled by political actors who would rather the population is focused on sectarian divisions than the grievances they have against the authoritarian regimes in power. So,
interesting. A couple of things. All right, we had the question here in the back, and I promised back here, so let's get to the back of the room.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Professor Itumele Motuhai from University of South Africa. I just want to ask a question. I must say, I think it's Dr. Obadare. I there's somewhere that I actually differ with you completely on the issue of universalization and the idea that says, look, United States is a beacon of hope. I actually completely differ with you on that. In South Africa, for example, the land is in the hands of the minority who happen to be white, number one. Number two, the economy is dictated upon by whites. So how do we speak of human rights in a context where the majority that live beyond poverty line are black? So how then, because the South African image of segregation was taken from the United States. If you compare the conditions of a black American in the United States, you have to compare it to South Africa. That's number one. Number two, I have also another problem is that we've got to look at the existential experiences, because it is the existential experiences of the people that should be translated into how we ought to translate and understand the notion of human rights. Now, when you look at the ideas of the Human Rights Charter, they came when a white man started killing another white man. Prior to that, the notion of human rights did not exist. Slavery continued. A disenfranchisement of black people continued without any problem. But when a white man started killing another white man, then we started talking about human rights. And exactly the same time, South Africa went into an apartheid system when here in the United States, in San Francisco, the Human Rights Charter was launched, where black people were further dislocated from their homes. Now, post-1994 in South Africa, we are told about these notions of human rights, which if you look at the South African Constitution, Chapter 1 of the South African Constitution talks about the Bill of Human Rights. Yet, the people who do not benefit from that are still the ones who did not benefit even during apartheid. Now, I need to ask you this question. Britain saw it and deemed it fit to the other United States to see to it that they put sanctions on Zimbabwe because Robert Mugabe refused to abide to them, regardless of the benefits and whatever that was going to affect the people of Zimbabwe. Rwanda, for example, becomes an example in which we can say, opposite the United States, opposite Western democracy, Rwanda gives us an alternative democracy where the cultural system is incorporated with Western system. So I'd like you to respond to that, please. Thank you.
Thank you. There's a lot to unpack there. I'm just going to say maybe three or four sentences, because, and then you and I can continue maybe over coffee or something. Rwanda is not a democracy. It's an authoritarianism pretending to be a democracy. You should look beyond culture. You're not seeing properly because of your affection, because you like Mugabe too. I thought Mugabe was a monster, by the way. And if you don't believe me, check the economic indices under Mugabe. Look at what happened to the people of Zimbabwe under Mugabe. I don't care about Mugabe. I care about Zimbabweans. I insist that the United States is a beacon of democracy. Of course. The United States is by no means perfect. And it has not always reconciled its creed with its actions. But that creed is sound. You don't believe me? Look at Venezuelans. Look at Mexicans. Look at Paraguayans. Look at Nicaraguans. Thousands of people are dying, struggling to come to the United States. I came out of my own volition. I love the United States. I am aware of historical injustices in the United States. And I think that if you are going to have any problem at grappling with those injustices, human rights is your friend. It's not your enemy. The fact that an advocate for a good has been disreputable does not change the advocacy itself. You're mixing categories here. Human rights are universal. Even in South Africa, right? So you talk about economic disparity between black people and white people. And then I will challenge you. South Africa has been under black rule since 1994. Right? Let black people in South Africa take possession of their own destiny. If they are going to do that, you know what's going to help them? The language of human rights. The human in human rights. If you focus on the human in human rights, it means you pay attention to the economy. It means you pay attention to the infrastructure. One of the things that the intelligentsia outside the United States has to stop doing is to stop holding outsiders responsible for their own problems. I saw that trope in your questions.
Can I maybe add a couple of things here? I mean, I must say that I also would not completely agree with a couple of statements here. One, you know, that the U.S. should be viewed as a beacon of democracy. Now, I would definitely accept that the U.S.'s relationship with the human rights paradigm has been complex, and there have been times where it's had a positive impact. But there's also a lot of problems there that we don't have time to kind of really get into. And the other is the statement that was made earlier that it doesn't matter who it is who's invoking human rights. I think that it does sometimes matter, doesn't always, but sometimes it does matter. So, you know, there's an image I showed my students of, and I forget the name of the U.S. Congresswoman from New York who had worn a burqa where she did the speech in front of Congress. I'm sorry?
Is it one of the squad, I think? I'm trying to jinx your memory.
So she wore a burqa, did a speech on Afghan women and their oppression. So I showed that image, and this is in the context of the U.S. wars, right? And then an image of an Iranian woman who's holding up the scarf she's taken out. And both of those people are challenging, mandatory hijab in a sense. And I asked my students to think about what's the difference, right? And I think that there is a lot of difference there because there's a lot of baggage and civilizing mission that goes with the first picture. And there's, you know, it's an act of agency in the second picture that's, you know, not there in the first. So there's a lot of layers there. Now, I do believe that you have to try to make your tent big as you can and bring in people and engage with people, even though there may be some disagreements. But it does matter. I mean, there's a very political context that can be brought in with someone invoking sympathies for human rights in this place or that place. So what is happening that I think is very interesting is increasingly there's south-to-south human rights learning. Right? So Chile is a place where if you don't know about Chile, there's tremendous advances taking place that incorporate social and economic rights. And I guess it also goes to the last question we had in the sense that, you know, traditionally, again, Western-driven human rights discourses have been very neoliberal, right? And in South Africa, you had the Truth and Reconciliation process that dealt with civil and political rights violations and nothing about the economic structures, right? But what's happening, I see, in the Global South is a new generation of human rights activists who are very attuned to these dynamics and are changing what we mean by human rights so that it's not in the forms that have traditionally been as problematic. Now, will they be, you know, successful in making human rights a more politicized and politicized in the sense that it looks at political structures and more meaningful discourse? I don't know, because they're also up against a lot in that project. But I think the South-to-South learning is also very interesting. and cooperation.
Exciting. All right, we have a little time for some more questions. Someone down in the front, and then over here, perhaps we could take two at a time. Yeah, right here in the front, kind of came up first. Mm-hmm. Trying to get them as they come in and get around the room.
Thank you very much. This has been terrific. I'm wondering, and I'm asking out of my own guilt, should we have left Afghanistan or should we have stayed?
Big one. Since that's a big one, let's also take this one over here on the right behind you in the gray sweatshirt, just so we can get in as much as possible. And
thanks. My name is Laura Alexander. I'm at University of Nebraska at Omaha. I teach a course called Religion and Human Rights. So this is one of those deceptively simple questions. I want to know what to talk to my students about. In your work with communities on the ground, when you see folks who are protesting against unjust structures, who are protesting for their rights to control their, I shouldn't say rights, protesting to control their own body, do you see folks using language other than the language of rights or of human rights? Or do you primarily see those groups really continuing to use the language of human rights so that that remains that kind of fundamental language that folks will talk about?
Thanks.
Do you want me to go ahead? Yeah. So I mean, again, this is why I said the Middle East has moved on from the project of political Islam. So in Iran, you know, we had several cycles where people were pursuing reform from within, and that entailed making the case for rights through religious discourses, couching rights claims in Iran. That it's somewhat unique because that's what you had the space to do. The government, you didn't have much more space to use secular framing. But in any case, I mean, this was also happening in other Arab countries where you try to bring in religious communities through religious framing. But I think that these societies, definitely Iran is in a different place right now. And by and large, you know, the move is more towards secular couching of rights at this point. In Iran, I'm paying careful attention to the slogans being used. I don't see... The only reference to religion that I saw was one slogan that says, you know, rape in prisons, where is that in the Quran? Mm. And it's an indictment of, obviously, this regime that claims religious morality. But beyond that, people have moved on to very secular discourses. So in terms of the Afghanistan, I mean, it's such a difficult... so much of... the problems in Afghanistan, as in Iran, you know, it's like Western intervention played such a critical role in the rise of the Mujahideen, you know, in Afghanistan historically, and kind of religious politics in Afghanistan. And so then everything that happens post 9/11, I mean, so... ultimately, I say yes, the U.S. had to leave because it couldn't be there forever, and it's a fight. The, you know, the Afghan people and Afghan women, it's a fight they're going to have to create the space for. But again, I mean, just as in Iran, I don't think it's something that outside... now, outside forces can be somewhat supportive in certain ways, but ultimately it's a fight for the people themselves. And it's fascinating to see Afghan women protesting, even though they are now subjected to much, I mean, and replicating some of the same slogans in Iran, even though they, you know, are subjected to much more brutal repression right now and have much less space to try to push forward a movement like this. But yeah, I mean, I think part of the reason, I mean, Afghan women suffer from, again, what I call the double curse of Western hegemony. So, you know, the savage victim savior formulation and then the overcompensation for that, which obscures what people on the ground experience at the hands of again, forces that claim to be, you know, furthering religion, right? So, you know, I think if Iran goes in the direction that we hope, I hope that it does, it'll open up space for a lot of other places in the region and maybe one day Afghanistan too. I mean, I don't want to say it's just because of Iran, but I think it'll be, you know, it'll influence, it'll have a positive influence, I think.
Afghanistan, I think it depends on the question of why you think, what your sense of why we went to Afghanistan in the first instance.
Right.
If you think it's, we went there for the sake of oil and geopolitical, you know, that, you know, reasons, you know, maybe. If you think we actually have, you know, anything to do, you know, to help countries, you know, under the cause of, you know, different kinds of, you know, autocracy, maybe you say yes. But what I want to say is, I really don't think we should give up on intervention. See, the world has attracted so much opprobrium of late, understandably, because the United States has not always covered itself in glory. But it would be the wrong lesson to take from that to then say, we will never intervene in the affairs of other people. We will not go. There are different kinds of troubles. There are troubles that come looking for you, and you find that you have to actually, I mean, so should we intervene in Ukraine? Of course we should. We're doing the right thing. The people of Ukraine are repelling an odious dictatorship. The moral line for me couldn't be clearer. We should be there. We should commit resources. We should fight it to the last. And it's the same way I think about what we do, you know, outside the United States. There are times we've behaved. Look, I know more about the history of American misbehavior, probably more than anyone else in this room. But we shouldn't give up on the agency of the United States to do good. This is the only country that can muster the kind of resources, you know, that it only can muster. Let me twing at your heart a little bit here. Do we all remember Malala Yousafzai, the young woman? Do you think it's okay to help people like that go to school? Don't you think it's okay to repair regimes that prevent women from going to school? And you're going to hold back because of accusations of you're intervening in another country? Not all interventions are alike. There are good interventions, there are bad interventions. The West should commit to the good type, the West should renounce the bad type.
All right, room for two quick.
Let me just say once. I think that's there's a lot to dissect there, because who decides what's a good intervention and what's a bad intervention, right? And how do we define, I mean, the intervention, are we talking about military interventions here?
No. There are different kinds of intervention. There are times when the United States and the West are the only agents that people suffering can call upon. Don't pretend that you don't know that, because it's coming next week or the week after, and it's going to be a moral problem, and you are going to have to address it. You can't say because you've gotten certain things wrong in the past that you are no longer going to try in the future. There are bad interventions. I agree with you. We should forfeit those. We should try as much as possible. But if people under tyranny call on us for help, we should give them help. That's what the United States is about.
So we recognize there's some gray area there, and if we had time, we would create some more nuance of framework,
yes,
right?
Sure,
and stand to the standards of, like, human rights is a thing. We want to stand for it, protect it in some way, and not make it so relative that everybody's frozen and can't do anything, which is where we're at, and that is a tough, tough order. We would need several hours to unpack our framework,
yes,
wouldn't we? But we're trying to compensate here, too, I think, for some of the extremes. Okay, so we have somebody in the middle here and somebody here. Let's take these two really quick, and then we need to wrap. Thanks for being persistent.
Hello, thank you for your comments. My name's Rich Proceda. I'm an attorney, and I studied law and international service at American University. And I'm also founding the Truth and Democracy Coalition, which works to build a pro-democracy movement in America in order to promote and defend democracy locally, nationally, and globally. So I have two questions. The first is for Dr. Abdari, and then the second is for both of you. When we look at the Economist Democrat Index of Democracies, we see that in Africa, I like to say, sometimes I say the Iron Curtain runs through the heart of Africa. Yet in South America, we have mostly democracies. And the question is, why? And then the second question is what does protecting, defending, promoting democracy in Ukraine, Iran, and Africa look like?
Big. Wow. We had a second question over here. Go ahead, throw it on the table, and we'll see what we can get to. Keep going.
Okay. On.
Yep.
Oh, I'm Ophir. I'm from the AAAS Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion. My question is about technology and the role that it plays in democratic backsliding or democracy building. Mm-hmm. 24 years old, Gen Zer. I feel like I've lived the majority of my adult life, especially post-COVID or during COVID, online. And I was just wondering what, you know, and whether it is in your own regions, the regions that you study, America, beyond, but what role does technology play both as a tool of oppression and as a tool for civil society, and especially in the wake of Twitter being a tool of, you know, information sharing, but also now being a little bit of a dumpster fire. So I wonder if you can speak to that.
Do you want me?
Go ahead.
Yeah, social media. Yes, I don't know if you know what happened in Nigeria in 2020, October 2020, the End SARS protest. Most of the people who took part in the protest were just people like you, Gen Zers, and you know a little bit older. But I think I'm bringing it out because one of the things they did was to use the power of social media to. So this is a very vast subject, of course, but you could sort of see social media going in one direction, being used positively to advance democratic, you know, to expand democratic space, you know, to support, you know, human rights struggle. But you could also sort of see in the pushback by reactionary forces, you know, working for the state to use social media to sort of, I mean, think about what President Trump did with his Twitter handle. There's a whole study there about how occupiers of, you know, of state office can manipulate, you know, social media. So social media is going to be with us, you know, for the foreseeable future. How we deal with it as, you know, as human beings is going to be the issue. Ukraine. Before you get to Ukraine before you get to democracy in Ukraine, you left something out. You have to keep Ukraine as a country. If Ukraine is not a country, how is it going to be democratic? The most important thing we have to do is to make sure that we help the people of Ukraine in their struggle to maintain their territorial sovereignty. Once we have that, we can then have it. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons why I think, other than the fact that its territory is being invaded by a hostile neighbor, the fact that philosophically we see eye to eye with the people of Ukraine, that it's a democracy, however flawed it is, makes it all the more incumbent on us, you know, to give support to Ukrainians.
On the social media front, I mean, so there was a lot of celebrating of social media around 2011 with the Arab uprisings. And then we saw the dark side of it and the way that a lot of, particularly, you know, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Iran, I mean, a lot of these governments figured out very quickly how to not only, you know, target dissidents through social media, but to, you know, manufacture and disseminate this all sorts of disinformation, which then, you know, circulates as misinformation. And they have been very, very effective at that. And it, you know, and it's, so it's like the pendulum has swung, but then now that I look at Iran, I mean, I see both effects very almost evenly. I mean, I don't see how these protests could have, we're now in, what, the end of the second month, I think we're in week 10. I don't think how it, that it would have endured without people being able to get those videos online and the world seeing what's happening. At the same time, there's a lot of misinformation. I mean, I shouldn't say this in public. My mother-in-law, one of the people that, you know, sent me an image that was an iconic image of the Egyptian uprising. It's called the Blue Bra Incident. So it's a woman that, you know, security forces are beating. She's a protester, and she's undressed. She's got a veil, so she's religious, but you can see her blue bra is you know. And so my mother-in-law, who's Iranian, sent this to me as an example of, you know, the Iranian government's moral hypocrisy, as if we needed more examples. But it's just, you know, she doesn't know. And I had to tell her this is actually from, you know, Egypt, not Iran. And then she stopped sending me things. So I was like, oh, this is bad. I need her to send this for my research. But in any case, it's both are, and that's somewhat benign example of misinformation. But there's, you know, more problematic ones. In terms of what intervention is helpful in Iran, I'll just limit it to Iran quickly. This is the big question. So it used to be the U.S. don't say anything because then the government could shut it all down by calling this a U.S. agenda and a Western intervention. And so activists treaded so lightly, had such a confined space within which to operate. And what I think is fascinating is that a lot of, led by diaspora activists who have, you know, unfortunately taken it a little bit to the extreme, but they have opened up the space so that, you know, you can say, Biden administration make a statement on this, and a lot of them actually go much farther, and it's, you know, I'm not quite there at all, but, you know, sanctions are okay, and even, you know, there's an interesting segment of the population outside and inside Iran who would have loved Trump to start a war in Iran because they saw that as the only avenue for them to be able to get rid of this regime. I mean, they couldn't see any other way to get out of the grips of the regime. And there's, of course, a lot of trauma, and there's a lot of other things going on. But I think, you know, it is interesting that they've now opened up a space where, you know, at least statements are possible. But I think just the issue, international spotlight on the protests in Iran and elsewhere in the region is very helpful because even the Islamic Republic of Iran really does not want to have all of this bad press that it's getting. It does have an impact.
Incredible. Unfortunately, we need to wrap. I want to thank our audience. You all have asked incredible questions, and to Dr. Obadari and Dr. Mukhtari. It's been inspiring and illuminating and complexifying. So thank you.
Thank you.